Ken Hudnall, this is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West, the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is April 22nd, 112th day of the year. 253 days remain till this year is over with and we start a new one. Okay, holidays and observances. In God We Trust Day, International Mother Earth Day, Stephen Lawrence Day, National Pinup Day. It's also National Baseball Day, National Girl Scout Leaders Day, Earth Day, National Jelly Bean Day, National Beagle Day, National MS Week, National Stop Snoring Week, Administrative Professionals Week. They're no longer secretaries, they're administrative professionals. Every Kid Healthy Week, National Volunteer Week, FOP Awareness Month, Coin Week. Famous people born on this date: Jack Nicholson, Amber Heard, Jeffrey Dean Morgan, Machine Gun Kelly, and Robert Oppenheimer. April is also International Guitar Month, National Card and Letter Writing Month, National African American Women's Fitness Month, Financial Literacy Month, Scottish American Heritage Month, Step Up for 30 for Bowel Cancer Month, Global Volunteer Month, National Alcohol Awareness Month, National Soy Foods Month, National Food Month, National Month of Hope, National Soft Pretzel Month, Animal Cruelty Prevention Month, National Volunteer Month, Sexual Assault Awareness Month, National Kite Month, National Garden Month, National Poetry Month, Autism Acceptance Month, National Pickleball Month, Limb Loss and Limb Difference Awareness Month, Stress Awareness Month, National Jazz Appreciation Month, Poetic Earth Month, National Couple Appreciation Month, Adopt a Ferret Month, a lot of ferrets in Congress, as I've said, Straw Hat Month, Month of the Military Child, Cemetery Changeover Month, Active Dog Month, National Decorating Month, and Parkinson's Awareness Month. Now, in 1500, Portuguese navigator Pedro Alvarez Cabral lands in Brazil. Carnival was not going on in spite of rumors to the contrary. 1519, Spanish conquistador Hernan Cortes establishes a settlement at Veracruz, Mexico. 1529, Treaty of Zaragoza divides the eastern hemisphere between Spain and Portugal along a line 297.5 leagues east of the Moluccas. That's about 780 miles, give or take. 1809, second day of the Battle of Egmont. Austrian army is defeated by the First French Empire army led by Napoleon and driven over the Danube into Regensburg. 1836, Texas Revolution. A day after the Battle of San Jacinto, forces under Texas General Sam Houston identify Mexican General Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna among the captives of the battle when some of his fellow soldiers mistakenly give away his identity. 1864, Congress passes the Coinage Act of 1864. It permitted the inscription of "In God We Trust" to be put on all coins minted in the as well as United States currency. 1876, the first National League baseball game is played at the Jefferson Street grounds in Philadelphia. 1889, at noon, thousands rush to claim land in the land rush of 1889. The Nowers, the cities of Oklahoma City and Guthrie, have formed with populations of at least 10,000. 1898, Spanish-American War. President McKinley calls for 125,000 volunteers to join the National Guard and fight in Cuba, while Congress more than doubles the regular army forces to 65,000. 1906, intercalated games open in Athens. 1915, World War I. The use of poison gas in World War I escalates when chlorine gas is released as a chemical weapon in the Second Battle of Ypres. 1930, UK, Japan, and United States signed the London Naval Treaty, regulating submarine warfare and limiting shipbuilding. 1944. First Air Commando Group, using Sikorsky R-4 helicopters, staged the first use of helicopters in combat with combat search and rescue operations in the China-Burma-India Theater. 1944, World War II, Operation Persecution is initiated. Allied forces land in the Hollandia, currently known as Jayapura area of New Guinea. Also in 44, World War II, in Greenland, the Allied Sledge Patrol attacked the German Bassgeiger weather station. 1945, World War II, prisoners at the Jasenovac concentration camp revolt. 520 are killed and about 80 escape. 1945 also saw Sachsenhausen concentration camp being liberated by soldiers of the Red Army and Polish First Army. 1948, Arab-Israeli War. Port city of Haifa is captured by Jewish forces. You know, what's interesting, our illustrious president just announced the Israelis invaded Haifa. He overlooked the fact that Haifa is in Israel. 1951, Korean War. Chinese People's Volunteer Army began assaulting positions defended by the Royal Australian Regiment and the Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry at the Battle of Kaepyeong. 1954, Red Scare. Witnesses began testifying and live TV coverage of the Army McCarthy hearing begins. 1969, British yachtsman Sir Robin Knox Johnston wins the Sunday Times Golden Globe race and completes the first solo nonstop circumnavigation of the world. 1969, formation of the Communist Party of India, which is Marxist-Leninist, is announced at a mass rally in Calcutta. 1970, First Earth Day is celebrated. 1974, Pan Am Flight 812 crashes on approach to Nagura Rai International Airport in Denpasar, Bali, Indonesia, killed all 107 people on board. 1977, optical fibers first used to carry live telephone traffic. 1992, a series of gas explosions ripped through the streets in Guadalajara, Mexico, killed 206 people. 1993, 18-year-old Stephen Lawrence is murdered in a racially motivated attack while waiting for a bus in Wellhall, Eltham. 2005, Japan's Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi apologizes for Japan's war record. 2016, the Paris Agreement is signed, an agreement to help fight global warming. Oh, please, it's a natural effect of circling the Earth, the sun. 2020, four police officers are killed after being struck by a truck on the Eastern Freeway in Melbourne while speaking to a speeding driver, marking the largest loss of police lives in Victoria Police history. Well, you cannot win them all. Well, we've talked about a lot of things. Last week it was lost treasures and hauntings in Texas. This week we're going to talk about the world's most notorious cold case. And that's the unsolved mystery of the one and only Jack the Ripper. There's still research into who he might have been. I've heard suggestions of everybody you can imagine. Even the Prince of Wales. Well, it was during the summer and fall of 1888. Fear filled the crowded slums of Whitechapel. That was a very poor district in Victorian London. It was also being inundated by migrants from other countries. Police found a body, and then another body. Women who lived in the neighborhood and worked as prostitutes. And, of course, the crime shocked the city and set off a search for a killer. And that search has gone on for more than 150 years. Now, the women had been brutally murdered. the last one, the most mutilated of all. Now, police searched the crime scenes for clues and scrambled to find a witness who could lead him to a suspect. And what they uncovered always led to suspects with credible alibis. The press, which of course followed the case with a mixture of concern and sensationalism, reflected the frustrations of many in Whitechapel. They wanted to feel safe again, even in a neighborhood known for its poverty and crime. Now, there's also the issue that there's the official number that the government confirmed, and then the actual number. And the actual number, according to rumor and legend, was two or three times what the government admitted. Now, as the killings and the manhunt went on, the London News Service got a letter purportedly from the killer. And in it, he gave himself a nickname that has continued to fascinate researchers since that time. Jack the Ripper. He taunted the police for their inability to catch him, promised to keep ripping until he was caught. And the killings did go on for at least several more weeks. Then murders that seemed to match Jack's M.O. stopped. Now, killings in Whitechapel and other parts of London did go on, but none fit the pattern of recognizable in regard to Jack's gruesome work. And now, some people tried to connect some of the other murders to the Ripper, but most students of the case claim that Jack committed just five or six murders. There are those that claim he committed 10 or 12. Official records attribute only five accepted victims to Jack the Ripper. And after 1888, he seemed to vanish. Maybe he died, fled to the country, or was locked up for other crimes. Or maybe he just decided to stop killing and go back to what you might call a normal life. Whatever happened to him, his identity has remained a mystery. But for more than 100 years, this most famous of cold cases has inspired scores of questions and theories about Jack the Ripper. And students of the Whitechapel murder wonder, who was Jack? How many did he actually kill? Why did he kill? And who might have helped him get away with his crimes? And almost from the very first, this mystery has inspired countless books and films and TV shows. Today, visitors to London can tour the sites where he murdered his victims. I did that when I was there. I also went to Sherlock Holmes' address. It's a bank. And they actually have a secretary whose job is to answer letters sent to Sherlock Holmes. An entire industry has sprung up about Jack and his unsolved killings. Now, amateur sleuths and retired police officers continue to develop theories and uncover what they say are hard facts to back them up, and even turn to science through DNA analysis to try to determine, once and for all, who Jack the Ripper might have been. Now, from the beginning, the difficulty of identifying Jack led to some outlandish and unsavory theories. The arrival of large numbers of immigrants during the mid and late 19th century stirred anti-Semitism that has existed in England since medieval times, leading some Londoners to point fingers at the foreign-born living in the East End. In fact, the first suspect in Ripper case was actually a Jewish immigrant. However, as the murders went on, the helpful public offered other suggestions about Jack's identity. One theory that I found interesting was the fact the murderer was actually a great ape that roamed the streets, or a member of an East Indian sect killing the women for body parts. And one writer suggested that the actor then starring on stage in the role of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde had become too engrossed in his role and carried out the maniacal killings after leaving the theater at night. And a number of psychics wrote to the police claiming they'd actually seen the killer using their powers. Well, the removal of internal organs figured prominently in the murder of Annie Chapman, the second murder victim to the Ripper. That's at least attributed to the Ripper. Her autopsy showed Jack cut out her uterus. When Baxter, the coroner on the case, said he had been informed by an official of the medical laboratory that somebody, an American, contacted the museum seeking several uteruses and willing to pay for them. Evidently, the unnamed American had approached another institution as well and had been rebuffed both times. Leading British medical authorities dismissed the idea that somebody would need to pay for body parts in order to conduct research. But to some people, Baxter's story resonated as they recalled William Burke and William Hare, who in the 1820s first robbed graves to provide cadavers for a doctor and then moved on to killing their victims outright. Murder could be lucrative, as Burke and Hare learned before they were caught and hung. And the clues found at the crime scenes, the stories of witnesses who thought they might have seen Jack, and the autopsy results, none of it helped police find a suspect for the Whitechapel murders. The speculation did continue about Jack's identity. Internal police documents listed several suspects, including an English solicitor and a Polish hairdresser. Over the decades, some of the people put forth as suspects seemed credible, such as murderers convicted of other crimes elsewhere. Well, the suggestions were a little bit more far-fetched. Jack was identified as a member of the royal family, Prince of Wales, as I said. The author and mathematician Charles Dodson, better known as Lewis Carroll, wrote Alice in Wonderland. And Lord Randolph Churchill, the father of Winston Churchill. Now, any of those having been convicted of being Jack the River would have caused a major disruption of British society. And his new theories were suggested. One was particularly intriguing. Herman Webster Mudgett, better known across the U.S. as H.H. Holmes. He was a 19th century serial killer who confessed to killing 27 people. His great-great-grandson, attorney Jeff Mudgett, came to believe there was a good chance that H.H. Holmes had carried out at least some of the Whitechapel murders that accredited Jack the Ripper. His evidence was, he admitted, circumstantial, but he became convinced he had solved the mystery of Jack the Ripper's identity. Others, of course, remained skeptical, including a lot of Ripperologists. That's the name given the people who've devoted years, even decades, to studying the case. And though people before Mudgett have claimed to have conclusive proof about Jack's identity, most of those claims have been debunked. And maybe Mudgett was right. Maybe not. But the search for Jack the Ripper will continue. People around the world have become fascinated with the mystery of who Jack the Ripper really was and why he mutilated random women in the dark streets of Victorian London. Now, there are five victims that British law enforcement confirmed and will confirm to this day were victims of Jack the Ripper. First was Mary Ann Nichols, found dead August 31st, 1888. She was found in Bucks Row, that's Durwood Street in London. The second was Annie Chapman, found dead on September 8th, 1888, in Hanbury Street in Spitalfields, London. Elizabeth Stride, she was referred to as Long Liz by most of the folks that knew her, found dead September 30th, 1888, in Duffel's Yard at Berner Street in London. Catherine Eddowes, found dead on September 30th, 1888, in Meter Square in London. That was his double event that he had warned about in a letter he sent to the police. And in Mary Jane Kelly, a very lovely young lady, found dead November 9th, 1888, on Dorset Street in Spitalfields. She was mutilated in her own home. She was said to have been a prostitute, and apparently took the wrong person home with her. Well, we also have a number of other murders. There was a bank holiday on the night of April 6, 1888. 39-year-old Martha Tabram, also known as Emma Turner, strolled the streets of Whitechapel en route to what was referred to as a pub crawl. That was the last night of her life. She was out for the evening with her friend Marianne Conley. And Conley was known on the streets as Pearly Paul. Two women, both prostitutes and both heavy drinkers, started their drinking spree about 10 p.m. Met up with two soldiers. Just before midnight, each woman wandered off with one of the men, presumably to ply her trade. Later, after Tabram parted from her soldier, she headed for nearby George Yard, a narrow street that led to some small courts and alleyways. If you've never been to East End in London, it's a maze. About 3:30 in the morning, cab driver Alfred Crowe came back to his apartment along George Yard. As he climbed the stairs, he saw a body lying on the landing. He didn't stop to investigate. An hour later, John Reeves, a dock worker, saw the same body. Well, he took a closer look and found Martha Tabram lying in a pool of blood. Well, he ran to the main road and got a police constable named Thomas Barrett. And Barrett summoned the local doctor, Timothy Killeen, who arrived on the scene. He noted Tabram's dress had been torn, exposing her breast and pulled up above her waist. After an examination, Killeen pronounced Tabram dead and said she'd been stabbed 39 times. Later estimated she'd been dead about 3 hours when he arrived at George Yard. Reporting on the death a few days later, the neighborhood newspaper called Tabram's death a mysterious murder, which has not been equaled in shameful brutality for many years past. Well, at the inquest, Colleen gave a more detailed report on her wounds based on the autopsy he performed. She'd been stabbed in the lungs 7 times and once in the heart. The latter puncture, he averred to the court, would have been enough to kill her. Also found stab wounds in her throat and liver, spleen, stomach. Another one went through her sternum. Colleen believed a larger weapon had been used for that blow compared to the others. Well, Pearly Paul was called to testify and recounted the time she'd spent with Tabram on the night of August 6th. Considering her a key witness, the police arranged for her to look over possible suspects, all guards at the Tower of London. Paul assured the police she could identify the two men she and Tabram had been with before the murder. But she said the two men were not among the guards in the lineup. And the police arranged another lineup with a different group of soldiers. Paul picked out two men she said were the ones, but unfortunately for her, they had solid alibis. Another potential witness was Constable Barrett. Early in the evening of August 7th, before he'd been called to the murder scene, he had seen a soldier near George Yard. Man said he was waiting for a friend who had gone off with a prostitute. Like Paul claimed, Barrett claimed he would be able to identify the soldier if he saw him again, so he went to the lineup as well. But the soldier he identified had an alibi for his whereabouts when the murder took place. The inquest concluded later in August with the jury determining Tabram had been killed by some person or persons unknown. But if you notice, she's not included in the confirmed 5 victims of Jack the Ripper. And if, in fact, she was also killed by him, she was the first one. Well, one of the victims that we mentioned was Mary Ann Nichols. She was the one killed August 31st. Now, early on the morning of that day, she walked the streets of Whitechapel, tired and drunk. About 12:30 in the morning, she left the frying pan, a pub on the corner of Brick Lane and Thrall Street, and headed for the nearby rooming house where she was staying. But she was turned away because she didn't have the nightly fee to claim a bed. Undeterred, Nichols, who also went by the name of Polly, headed back to the streets to earn her money, she often did, by offering her body for sale. She turned 43, and she had not always been a prostitute. But a broken marriage and the loss of her job as a servant led her to a life on the street. And she'd already found several customers that night, with the money being spent to fuel her drinking binge. Now she wanted to find one last customer so she could make her way back to the bed waiting for her at the rooming house. About 2:30 in the morning, she walked along Osborne Street and ran into Emily Holland. Holland was coming back from the docks where she'd gone to watch two fires that had been blazing for a good part of the night. Two women had recently shared a room at another common lodging house as the cheap and crowded accommodations for short-term boarders were called. Seeing that Nichols was drunk, Holland encouraged Nichols to come with her, and Nichols refused, declaring that she'd earned the money for her bed. So Holland was the last known person to see Nichols alive. Less than 2 hours after Nichols and Holland parted, delivery man Charles Cross spotted something lying in a gateway as he walked along a side street called Buck's Row. Went over to investigate and realized it was a woman's body. Another delivery man named Robert Paul came on the scene and watched as Cross touched the woman's hand. It was cold, though when he touched her face, it was warm. According to Cross, she had just died. Paul said she just might be drunk, and the two left the scene, ran into Constable John Mizzen and told him about the body they'd discovered. But before Mizzen could reach Nichols, another officer found her in the street. He summoned Dr. Henry Llewellyn, who pronounced Nichols dead. Though like Cross, he could feel some parts of her body were still warm, a sign that her killing had been very recent. Well, the policeman's lanterns revealed to Llewellyn and what Cross and Paul hadn't seen, two gashes across her throat. At the mortuary, the doctor noticed more cuts on her abdomen. And at the inquest, he noted the various cuts and described some of them. The longest slash to the neck, about 8 inches, went down to her spine. He said the neck cuts could have been caused by a long-bladed knife, moderately sharp, used with great violence. And several of the cuts on the abdomen were deep. Doctor's opinion, the murderer was facing Nichols when he killed her and used the same weapon to cause all the wounds. Now, at this point, with Marianne Nichols being our topic of discussion, who was the first official victim, ripperologists disagree about whether Martha Tabram was actually the Ripper's first victim. Skeptics point out that her murder differed from the ones that followed, but several experts on the case are willing to accept her as a real Ripper victim. That would make six. Now, more uncertainty surrounds the death of Emma Smith, who preceded Tabram's by 4 months, which also took place in Whitechapel. Smith, who seemed to make at least some of her money as a prostitute, was attacked by unknown assailants during a robbery. She actually died from an infection of her wounds. Unlike the other Ripper murders, the weapon was a blunt instrument, not a knife. Now, interest in her death grew in London later in 1888 after the Ripper murders. Some newspapers speculated her death was linked to the later ones, but and years after the Whitechapel killings, Walter Dew, a constable in the area in 1888, offered his opinion that Smith was actually Ripper's first victim. Today, few other people connect Jack to the Smith murder, though the story of her death does appear in books on the case. The problem is, word of mouth can confuse almost any investigation. Well, going back to the Nichols murder, police didn't find any clues near where her body was found, or even along Bucks Row. Residents and workers in nearby slaughterhouse had not heard anything about the time the murder took place. And anyone with blood on his clothes might not have drawn much suspicion since the East End had several slaughterhouses. Killer could have blended into the crowd out on Whitechapel Road, which is a main thoroughfare, which would have already been filled with people going to work at the market. Local newspapers reported on the gruesome murder. Some of it even reached the U.S., where the New York Times printed a sensational report on the crime. That story claimed the murder chased his screaming victim down the street. As the inquest went on, the East End Observer wrote that the killing had alarmed the neighborhood. It also said during the week, large number of people have visited the scene of the murders in Bucks Row, and they've discussed in whispers the details of the tragedy. The results of these discussions have invariably been a demand for more police protection. As fear gripped Whitechapel, rumors spread about grisly messages written on the walls and strange men seen with spots of blood on their hands. The coroner, Wynn Baxter, concluded his inquest on September 22nd. He said robbery wasn't a motive for the killing of Nichols. He also noted the killing had some similarities with Emmer Smith and Martha Tabor murders, including the victim's age, their profession, and the location of the crimes. To Baxter, Nichols' killer was certainly mentally disturbed, and he was also sure that this was a murder of the most atrocious character that's been committed. Well, the next name to be added to our list was Annie Chapman. Well, it was almost for 2 years Annie Chapman had gone through a tough stretch. As with Marianne Nichols, Chapman's excessive drinking had ruined her marriage and forced her to live on her own in London. And for a time, the 47-year-old had one advantage the others didn't. Her husband, she was separated from her husband. But they weren't divorced yet, so he sent her money. But those funds dried after her husband, whose name was John, died in 1886, which forced Chapman to actually have to scramble for money. She was known as Dark Annie. Sold matches and flowers on the street, though one friend thought Chapman had another source of income. Because at times, she used to remain out very late at night. During the first week of September 1888, she spent several nights at a doss house, which is another name for a common lodging house, in Spitalfields, a neighborhood next to Whitechapel. Also spent some time at a workhouse where people without money for a common lodging bed found even harsher conditions, though at least they had a roof over their head. And late on the night, September 7th, she was found back at the doss house where she shared a beer with another boarder. Then she went out to earn the money for her bed for the night. It was about 1:30 in the morning of the 8th when she left. Well, sometime after 5:15, a glass cutter named Charles Albert Kadosh got up to use the outhouse in the backyard of his house on Hanbury Street. Way back, he heard what he thought was a woman's voice saying no coming from the yard next door. That was at number 29, don't you know? A few moments later, he heard a sound of something falling against the fence. Now, he didn't investigate. He wasn't curious. Instead, he went inside and got ready to go to work. About 45 minutes later, John Davis, a tenant at number 29 Hanbury Street, went into the backyard and found the body of Annie Chapman with her dress pulled up to her waist. Scared at what he called the dreadful sight, he ran through the house and into the street. Found several men who came to look at the body and set off to fetch a constable. Found Joseph Chandler, an inspector at the nearby H Division of the Metropolitan Police. Going to the backyard of number 29 Hanbury, he inspected the body. Saw part of her intestines still connected to the body, draped over her right shoulder. Police Surgeon George Baxter Phillips arrived on the scene and saw more of the mutilation Chapman had suffered at the killer's hands. So signs of strangulation in her neck had been severed. Part of her stomach had also been removed from her body, along with her uterus. Details which the newspapers conveniently admitted. At the inquest for Chapman's murder, Elizabeth Long, a local cart minder, provided what seems to be the first description of the possible Whitechapel killer. She testified at about 5:30 in the morning of September 8th, she'd been walking down Hanbury Street on her way to Spitalfields Market. She knew what time it was because of the ringing of a nearby outdoor clock. She passed 29 Hanbury and saw a man and a woman talking on the street. She actually overheard part of their conversation, she said. She overheard him say to her, "Will you?" And she said, "Yes." Well, the witness was adamant. The woman in question was Chapman. Says she didn't get a good look at the man. Saw enough to testify he wore a brown hat with a low crown. And while she didn't see his face, she could tell he had a dark complexion. Apparently, you can get that from his voice. He's over 40 years old and taller than Chapman. Chapman was only 5 feet tall, so she thought he might be a foreigner. His overall appearance was what she called shabby genteel. Now, her testimony about the timing of what she saw and heard didn't square with Godoch's. Chief Inspector Donald Swanson, writing a few weeks after the murder, was inclined to trust Phillips, so he rejected Long's story since it seemed to offer the first real clues about the suspect. Other detectives came to share Swanson's view. Well, the clues found at the crime scene at 29 Hanbury Street were basically mundane. A comb, a piece of muslin cloth, an envelope containing pills that Chapman was taking for an illness. But a leather apron was found that sparked police interest. It belonged to John Richardson, the son of a tenant at the house, who testified he had gone into the backyard about 4:45 a.m. Hadn't seen anything suspicious at that point in time, and his mother explained she had washed the apron for him and left it in the yard to dry. So he was ruled out as a suspect. Now, as you might guess, London for that time and the notoriety of the killings, prejudice came into play. As the police tried to find a possible killer, some of the Whitechapel prostitutes talked to him about a man who sometimes terrorized him on the street. The women had nicknamed him Leather Apron because he always wore the uniform of a bootmaker. At least 1 month upon a police officer knew this man as John Pizer. He was a man in his late 30s, a Jewish immigrant from Poland. Reporting in the Star, which is a newspaper, speculated he was probably responsible for at least 3 Whitechapel killings. Newspaper stories focused on the fact that John Pizer was Jewish. Anti-Semitism, of course, was common in London at that point in time. Still is today. At that point in time, this was after waves of Jewish immigrants had fled Eastern Europe and settled in London. During the Victorian era, Jewish stereotypes often appeared in the literature. The idea that the killer of English prostitutes was a Jewish immigrant played into the anti-Semitism that was well established in England. Also reinforced the idea that many Londoners wanted to accept. Only a foreigner would commit such murders, not one of them. Turned out Pizer had solid alibis for the night of the first 2 murders. When police corroborated his testimony, he was removed from the list of possible suspects for the Whitechapel murders. The problem is, while they didn't lack for suspects, they did lack for evidence. Now, the lack of solid leads for the police investigating the Whitechapel murders led some residents of the area to take steps of their own. On September 10th, Samuel Montague, who represented the area in Parliament, offered a reward of £100, which was a lot of money in those days, information about the killings, and asked the police to print and distribute his flyers. Making the offer. The British government, though, through the Home Office, refused to let the police cooperate. A group of local business owners formed the Mile End, or the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee, sought to raise money for its own reward, and and also turned to the Home Office for help. And when that effort failed, the committee wrote directly to Queen Victoria. Once again, the government refused to offer a reward. Another committee for local residents, the St. Jude's District Committee, took a different approach. It was formed after the Marianne Nichols murder. Police put members out on the street between 11 p.m. and 1 a.m. to watch for suspicious activity. Helped the police when the need arose. In the days after Chapman's murder, fear and suspicion once again ran high in Whitechapel. For a time, the streets were unusually busy through the night because... were unusually busy, though, at night. Even read my own handwriting. They became mostly empty after midnight, and some East End prostitutes either moved to other areas or simply stayed indoors. East London Observer said residents were panic-stricken. Whenever the news of the arrest of a possible suspect hit the streets, mobs gathered outside the police station and shouted and hooted for the murderer of Annie Chapman. Shouts of vengeance, which went up from some thousands of throats on Saturday afternoon with no idle threats. Population was in no mood for the idle threats or idle words. They wanted action. Even crimes committed outside of Whitechapel tapped into the fear that gripped that part of London. After two men were attacked in the West End, the Star reported the wildest rumors in linking the assaults to the Whitechapel murders. Well, the inquest into Annie Chapman's murder went on through most of September, which, of course, kept the case in the news. 27th of September, the Daily News reporter who strolled through Whitechapel wrote that the effect of the shock has been visibly subsided and people are beginning to move freely about again. But any sense of calm that had returned in the neighborhood was soon to be shattered. On the night of September 29th, Elizabeth Stride left her Doss house on Flower and Dean Street and went out for a drink, something she did quite often. 44-year-old Swedish immigrant had an arrest record for being drunk and disorderly. Her drinking seemed to have often disrupted her relationship with a live-in companion, Michael Kidney. In her native country, she had worked as a prostitute, though in London she seemed to get by doing odd jobs. Just that day, she'd earned money cleaning rooms, and her fellow boarders thought she left for the evening in a good mood. During the course of the night, several people reported seeing Stride with at least one man and possibly more. Two men said they saw her outside a pub about 11 p.m. kissing a well-dressed man with a mustache. About 12:35 a.m., Constable William Smith was making his rounds on Burner Street when he spotted her with a red flower in her pocket. With her was a man wearing a dark coat and a deerstalker cap, the type made famous by the depictions of the fictional sleuth Sherlock Holmes. He said the man was clean-shaven, about 28, and had a package wrapped in a newspaper. The pair was standing opposite the International Working Man's Education Club, which was off of a courtyard on Burner Street. That club often sponsored talks on socialist politics, and one had taken place just that night. Well, Louis Dimschutz and his wife lived at the club, served as the building's managers. And after a night out trying to peddle cheap jewelry, Dimschutz returned to the club about 1 in the morning. As he entered the courtyard, a pony pulling a small wagon began to act strangely, and he saw an object to his right and went over to see what it was. When he lit a match, he could make out the body of a woman. It was Elizabeth Stride. She was dead. After the police were notified, Dr. Frederick Blackwell reached the club about 1:15, saw Stride's neck had been slashed with a cut deep enough to sever a windpipe. Doctor estimated she'd been dead about 30 minutes. Next day, Blackwell joined George Phillips in examining her body more closely. He found bruises and determined she'd died from loss of blood after the killer slashed her carotid artery. Well, after the crime, several other people reported having seen Stride before her murder. One man, though, may have seen the beginning of the attack that led to her death. On September 30th, local resident Israel Swartz went to the police to describe the altercation he had seen at 12:45 outside the Working Man's Club. After seeing Stride's body, he was sure she'd been the woman involved in the altercation he had seen. Turning down Berner Street, Swartz had seen a man walking ahead of him toward Stride, who was standing by the gate to the courtyard. The man spoke to Stride and pulled at her and threw her down on the pavement. Stride screamed, but not loudly. At that point, Swartz crossed the street and noticed another man lighting his pipe. The man assaulting Stride called out Lipsky. The last name had recently become a derogatory term for Jews after a man of that name was executed for murder. As Swartz left the scene, he noticed a man with the pipe was following him. Swartz couldn't tell if the two men knew each other or who the attacker was referring to when he yelled out Lipsky. Swartz was, in fact, Jewish, and Frederick Eberlein, one of the officers, police inspectors in Ripper murders, assumed the attacker meant Swartz. As he told his story to police, Swartz described the first man he had seen on Berner Street, about 30 years old, with a mustache, wearing dark clothes and a cap with a peak. Well, based on the police reports, police didn't seem to doubt Swartz, though according to newspaper accounts, he wasn't asked to testify at the inquest. Or maybe the paper simply failed to record his testimony as a later letter from a high-ranking police official claimed Swartz and did indeed appear at the inquest. In any event, Swartz's account led to many unanswered questions. Was the man he saw really the killer of Elizabeth Stride? And did that man know the man with the pipe? And what did he mean when he yelled Lipsky? Some things have never been answered. Well, most Ripperologists place Elizabeth Stride among the initial five victims of Jack the Ripper. But some folks have questioned if he was really her killer. And a number of things that have raised this issue is, number one, Stride had only a single cut, the one to her throat that killed her. Previous Whitechapel murders had seen each victim more horribly disfigured and mutilated than the last. And another, Stride showed no signs of strangulation, as Chapman had. In his complete Jack the Ripper, Donald Rumbelow suggests a man in the spot who was Stride that night she was killed was in love with her, and her death was a result of some sort of love triangle or domestic dispute. And those who think she was a Ripper victim suggest that the activity on Berner Street at a working man's club or the approach of Louis Dimchurch's wagon may have scared Jack off before he could finish mutilating Stride's body. Well, Metropolitan Police were still at the scene of Stride's murder when a constable in the City of London came upon another grisly scene. The city, which is the heart of London, had its own police force. In fact, the City of London and London are two different things. Patrolling in the darkness in Mitre Square about 1:45 a.m., Constable Edward Watkins found the body of Catherine Eddowes. The light from his lantern showed her dress had been pulled up, and a deep gash ran across her stomach. Watkins also saw another huge cut across her neck, so deep it almost severed her head. On the pile by the side, he ran for help. He found George Morris, a watchman at one of the warehouses at Lowndes Square. Morris ran to the main road, blew his whistle to signal for more help, and shortly a crowd gathered. Interestingly enough, just 45 minutes before Watkins found her body, Eddowes had left a nearby police station. Like the other Whitechapel victims, the 46-year-old was prone to drink too much. But unlike the others, no one who knew her reported she made money as a prostitute. Most modern writers, of course, who write about the Ripper case have labeled her a prostitute. She and her companion, John Kelly, lived together in the East End. Kelly last saw Eddowes on the afternoon of September 29th when he warned her to be mindful of the murderer who was still roaming Whitechapel. She assured Kelly she could take care of herself. She said, "Don't fear for me." That night, the police picked up Eddowes around 8:30 after a particularly heavy drinking bout. By 1 in the morning, she had convinced the constable she was sober enough to be allowed to leave the jail. And she was spotted shortly after she left. As you later testified, Joseph Lewindy, a traveling salesman, saw her just outside Meter Square, chatting with a man wearing a peak cap. He didn't get a good look at either one, but he said the man looked rather rough and shabby. He identified Eddowes by the jacket and hat she wore. As news of the murder spread, several police officers arrived on the scene along with two doctors. They saw blood that had drained out of the cut around her neck, and which had sliced her carotid artery. And as with the Chapman murder, the killer had mutilated her torso, pulling out some of the intestines and putting over his victim's shoulder. But there were some twists to this killing. He also cut a section of the intestines and placed it between Etel's body and the left arm. And imitating the Chapman killings, he also removed her uterus. But this time he took one of the victim's kidneys as well and sliced off part of one ear and her nose. After performing an autopsy, Dr. Gordon Brown suggested the killer must have had some knowledge of anatomy, though not necessarily that of a doctor. He said the butcher could have easily located the kidney as well. Well, you know, just before the dual murders that took place on September 30th, the police got what could have been a tantalizing lead in the Whitechapel murders, or maybe a hoax. But it became a key part of later Jack the Ripper lore. September 29th, Thomas Bulling of the Central News Agency passed on to Scotland Yard a note the agency got 2 days before. The Central News Agency, for those that are not familiar, wrote and distributed articles to newspapers just like the Associated Press. And Bulling said that the agency actually treated the note as a joke. Started off, "Dear Boss," and it was written in red ink. But the writer claimed to be responsible for the murders and mocked the police for not being able to find him. And he went on to say he would keep ripping prostitutes till he was arrested, and laughed at the notion he was a doctor. He also called the Chapman murder a grand one, saying, "I gave the lady no time to squeal." And at the end, he signed the letter Jack the Ripper, which was the first time that name was used. Like Bulling, some police officials doubted the letter's truthfulness, but Jack mentioned his intention to cut off a future victim's ear, just as Catherine Eddowes' killer done a few days after the letter was received. On October 1st, a postcard written in similar handwriting turned up at the Central News Agency. It referred to details in the previous letter and the recent double murders. This time the letter referred to himself as Saucy Jack. Some police officers began to think the correspondence might just actually have come from the killer. Now, the first newspaper report on the letter appeared October 1st, and soon its contents were reproduced and appeared across London, and everybody knew the name of Jack the Ripper. Well, the investigation of the Stride and Eddowes murders went on through October, with newspapers reporting descriptions of men supposedly seen with Stride before her death. Some of the witnesses said they saw a man holding a bag. Police questioned some suspects, but were never able to charge anybody. The Mile End Vigilance Committee had kept up its work to help police solve the murders and possibly prevent future ones. October 16th, its president, George Lusk, became an important part of the Ripper case. That day, he got a small package, and opening it up, he found what appeared to be half a human kidney and another note that seemed to be from Jack. The note started off with the words, "From Hell." And he said the kidney was from one woman, presumably Eddowes, and he'd fried and eaten the other half of it. Unlike the other two Ripper letters, this one was filled with misspellings, and the writer didn't refer to himself as Jack. It said, "Catch me if you can, Mr. Lusk." Several days after he got the package, Lusk brought the kidney to the London hospital for examination. And from there, went to the police, who had several doctors examine it as well. Well, the press soon learned about the gruesome contents of the package and spread rumors about the kidney. One report said it came from a woman about Eddowes' age and showed signs of disease that matched the condition of Eddowes' remaining kidney. The doctor at first examined the kidney, denied these specific details, but asserted it was indeed the left kidney of a human. Another doctor said the kidney had been placed in alcohol several hours after it was removed, and that seemed to disprove the suggestion as part of a hoax, and kidney been removed as part of an autopsy, which usually occurred a day or two after a death. Bodies kept for dissection in medical schools are preserved with a special chemical, not alcohol. Well, with conflicting medical reports, the police couldn't say for sure that the kidney had come from Eddowes' body. Bless reported soon after her murder, one of her kidneys had been removed, and Frankly, anyone could have sent a kidney, claiming it was Edo's. Today, students of the Ripper case still disagree about whether that kidney came from Edo's or not. And on that note, we come to the end of today's show. We'll be talking more about Saucy Jack tomorrow. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.